The second request, which is what we'll discuss this evening, was that we should have the chance to discuss together the Jewish attitude towards the technical question of the age of the earth and evolution. In other words, what should be our attitude? Not offended if you leave, if you're not, if you only got a mystical interest. I'll try and put in the mystical background also. But the problem is that now that we're reading Bereishis, we've just begun the Torah, and we're talking now about the creation and the essence of how the world came into being, so that creates, in a modern intellectual's mind, the problem of how we deal with the fact that we say that the world is only 5,700 years old, and the fact that science seems or claims to know that the world is actually 10 billion years old, or 15 billion according to most opinions since the beginning of the universe, 5 or 10 billion the existence of the earth. How do we deal with this discrepancy? And secondly, in the same breath, usually one is asked how we deal with the theory of evolution. Is this agreeable to you?
Yeah.
So let's see if we can try and make a bit of sense of this subject. First of all, let's start with the question of the age of the earth, the age of the universe. Let's start with that and we'll try and... Evolution actually is less of a problem. Neither of them is a problem, to tell you the truth. Neither one is a problem at all. But evolution, possibly in a group like ours where we've discussed mystical ideas, fits more directly into some of the things that we've said before. Because the mystical tradition is that man was created specifically from everything else on earth. It says that openly in the mystical writings, which means that we expect to find a human being as having traces or elements of all other beings. But we're not surprised at that. The only question is, in exactly which fashion did it happen? We'll get to that in Mr. Shem. Let's see what we have time for. Let's start with the question of how old the earth is and what we do with the evidence that, so-called evidence that's been amassed in terms of how old the universe is. Now, I'll try not to get too technical. I'm not capable of getting too technical. I'm not a physicist. But I probably researched the subject more than most people here, possibly. And therefore, I'll try not to get too technical, but just enough to be able to understand the concept. If you don't have a technical or scientific mind, I think you'll still be able to understand the basic ideas. And what I think you should understand, what my very sincere hope is that you'll be able to end this discussion with an understanding, not only that there's no evidence that they're right and we're wrong, if you want to put it that way, but on the contrary, modern scientific evidence is in excellent agreement with Torah understanding. Excellent agreement. In fact, there are many works that have been printed in the last 10 years, and especially 5, and especially the last 2 years, that have come out tying together the Torah description of various physical and cosmological phenomena, tying them together with the Torah description in literal terms. Never mind how we can fix it up by understanding mystically, but without going into the mystical background. And I think this is where a person should start his investigation. If you're interested in the subject and you want to read about it, I would suggest that you read a few books that have been published recently in very non-technical terms that take the simple text of Genesis and they show how they're in perfect agreement with the modern physical theories without any twisting at all. The most recent has been published now that I've seen by a professor from Bar-Ilan University. It's called In the Beginning. Highly recommend it. I don't think it's the, my own personal opinion, I don't think it's the way to deal with it from a mystical perspective, but it's an attempt to simply tie together the very simple chat, simple straightforward meaning in the words, with the most advanced theories in physics. Remarkable, remarkable discussion that you definitely won't be the same again after you read that. How do we deal with the fact that it says that Hashem separated light from darkness? How can you separate light from darkness? Darkness isn't something, it's the absence of light. Modern physics is in perfect agreement that that's what happened in what they call the Big Bang. There was a thing called darkness that held the light trapped. We're going to get into the technical physics of it. Where are the waters above the heavens? You remember it said that the waters that were separated into waters above the heavens and water, where the waters above the heavens? Modern cosmologists have discovered where those waters are. Many fascinating things that's worth reading. There are other books also. There's a little book called Permission to Believe. It's highly recommended. It doesn't prove anything from physics, but it shows you that you can at least take your pick equally from whichever way you wish to look at the world, and that the evidence scientifically, rational, scientific, non-religious evidence, just as strongly suggests the simple, straightforward meaning of the biblical text as it does the opposite. And I'll try and give you one or two examples from this field to try and illustrate the point. I'd be very happy if we'd be able to leave this evening knowing a little bit more about physics and science and seeing that if anything it proves the traditional Torah way of understanding things. Let's start with the following comment. Before we even begin the discussion, a Jew should know that many of the things we're about to discuss this evening are not essential. They're not essential at all. They're not fundamentals of belief. How old the world is, and exactly how you can see it, and whether the evidence does suggest that it's billions of years old, or whether the evidence doesn't, is not a fundamental axiom of Jewish belief. There are things that are much more fundamental that relate to the existence of Hashem and a human being's obligation on earth. And whether the evidence in the fossils or the rocks or whatever it is suggests that the world is so many billions of years, whether it's not, is not an axiom of Jewish belief. I'll put it to you this way. I once knew a young man who studied in Osama Yeshiva, and he had a lot of philosophical questions. In fact, his story has been documented in a book called Anatomy of a Search, which is a very interesting... It's a good book. Is this the author's questionable, but the book's good. In that book, in the third chapter, is detailed the story of this young man. It's a very interesting story. But one of the questions that he asked was this question about the age of the earth and evolution. And he chose to ask this question some 1 or 2 years later when he was traveling around the United States. He asked Rav Yaakov Weinberg, Rosh Hashiva of Baltimore, now he's still in Baltimore, he asked him this question. How do we understand he had problems with his emunah, with his faith in Jewish belief, in terms of the fact that science seems to suggest that the world is so old and that evolution took place and so forth and so on. And Weinberg answered him a very interesting answer. Before he went into a technical discussion of the scientific issues, he said to him the following thing. He said, before this discussion begins, you should know that there are some things in Torah that are negotiable and there are some things that are non-negotiable. It's a wonderful concept. First, you should get clear the things that are not negotiable. What a human being is, what his responsibilities are, what he's supposed to be doing in the world, what Hashem demands of you, what the Torah says about that, those are non-negotiable issues. Whether the fossils seem to be a billion years old, or whether that is negotiable. There are many ways to handle that question within a Torah perspective. There must be dozens of ways of answering that so-called difficulty, tying together the scientific evidence with the Torah evidence or description. There must be many, many ways. I'm not even going to touch most of them this evening. Let's choose one or two to show you some fascinating insight that you probably don't have, or many people don't have. That's the first thing a person should remember. What we're discussing this evening is negotiable. You don't like the way I see it, you can see it another way. It's negotiable, it's up to you. You want to believe that the rocks, examined objectively, suggest that they're billions of years old? You're allowed to believe that. How do you tie that up with 5,700? We'll try and explain that also. You want to believe that the evidence is forged? You can believe that also. You want to believe that it could be looked at in two different ways? You can believe that also. It doesn't say thou shalt believe anyway that the rocks are X years old, or that carbon dating is accurate the way they say. It doesn't say that anyway. It does say you have to believe in Hashem, and that you have to do what you're supposed to be doing on it. That's a very important point. So it should be appreciated that we're here in the negotiable area. The second provision or introduction I'd like to make is that it's with regret that we discuss the subject, because we usually reserve, Baruch Hashem, we've had a long record of using these Monday evenings to discuss Divrei Torah, which means to really discuss Torah subjects that are spiritual entirely. It's a great merit that we've had together. Here we're discussing what the scientists say and what the secular world says about things in order to discredit it, right, so that it shouldn't be a problem for our belief. Unfortunately, that is wading into the opposition, if you want to put it that way, right, which really we don't really have to stoop to, except that we have such a problem with emunah and with evidence and belief in this generation that unfortunately we do. One great sage talking about this subject, He said it about something much more controversial, but I'll certainly not prepare to mention that. He said that, I'm just prepared to put it in the hint that he used. He said that when one does not move into a new house in order to kill cockroaches, but it's something you have to do. In other words, that's not the object of why we're here. But since many people who would like to be here for the right reason have raised this question personally to me recently, it's evident that there's enough of a threat or a problem to clear, straightforward, clear-sighted belief from this area that it has to be dealt with. Let's pick out one or two fascinating... We can't discuss the whole subject. Let's pick out one or two fascinating ideas. I presume you're aware, should be aware, that according to Torah, according to our belief, our understanding, our knowledge, the world is 5,752 years old. Let's call it 5,700 years old in cosmic terms. According to the scientific model, which is very widely accepted now, there was a big debate until the last 15, 20 years about whether the universe is in steady state or whether the universe came into being in what they call a Big Bang. Today, the accepted cosmological theory is the so-called Big Bang theory. It will prove to be a Big Bang, this theory. But that is, it might turn out to be a fizzle, but whichever, whichever it is, that's the accepted theory, that the world began with what they call a Big Bang. It's a fascinating theory, and there's the majority of the scientific evidence is accepted to be in favor of this theory. The theory states that 15 billion years ago, 15,000 million years ago, approximately, the world came into existence in a flash of creation. That's what they say. Not what we say, that's what they say. They say that the world began, let's just be careful and try and understand this, you'll see that if you really just state their words, it's so close to saying it from a Torah point of view, the time factor we'll get into later, that almost doesn't require explanation. They say that the universe began as a speck of infinite density and infinite mass, infinitely small in size. Not bad that for a rational beginning. That infinite speck contained the whole universe. Are you with me? I mean, there was, at one time, the entire matter and energy of the universe contained in an infinitesimal speck. It was of infinite density and infinite mass. It then exploded into the form that we see today. Right? Exploded such that within the first few milliseconds, right, there's a book, in fact, called The First 3 Seconds, which is a description of modern cosmology and derives the existence of the present universe in just 3 seconds from that incredible moment. Within that moment, energy translated itself into matter and the universe materialized. Atoms materialized first in a form called plasma, then atoms materialized, hydrogen, helium, and through nuclear fission and fusion, matter in all its present form evolved and condensed into planets, into stars, into planets. And that process is continuing in a visible way, this is according to the theory, in that incredible moment of explosion, the universe began to explode and expand outward, and is still doing so. And there are well accredited measurements of all planetary and stellar bodies and masses moving away from each other at particular speeds, which tie in very well with this observation, measured by what's called the redshift Doppler effect. The technical stuff doesn't have to interest us right now, but the theory that it began with an explosion and therefore everything is moving away from itself should be check upable, and it is. There are also techniques that measure what's called the background radiation or the electromagnetic radiation or energy left over in the form of microwaves from the original Big Bang. About 20 years ago, these were discovered and measured, and also have widely held to be evidence of the same thing. And there's much experimental evidence to the extent that the major accepted theory today is that that's the way the universe began. Now, where did that infinite speck, that speck of infinite matter and density and so forth come from? Of course, they have no explanation, and they're ready to admit that. They say that it's beyond the tools of measurement. Listen carefully, because we're going to hear the same thing from a Torah point of view. Their contention is this: we can only describe what we can measure. If we see matter the way we know it, and energy the way we know it, we can measure it, we can apply certain measuring tools and make certain deductions. But when you take us back into a phase that doesn't obey the rules, when we get into the phase that deals with infinity, we can't make any comments about that, and they don't ask us where it came from. Because, you follow, we just haven't got the tools, we can't begin to measure and work with, therefore we'll start talking about when we can start. How it got there, we don't know, it's not of interest to us. Not of interest to us. We can't measure it. It's out of the realm of science. Actually, I feel obliged to tell you that lately it has become of interest to them, because there's been a tremendous movement, a worldwide movement for the last 10 years, certainly the last 5 years, among leading physicists to try and investigate the ultimate meaning. In other words, not just what we can describe, but actually how and why. And there's some remarkable books that have been written about this. The one that I'm thinking of, I'm not prepared to quote the name, because it compares Eastern mysticism to principles in physics. And most authorities hold one is not allowed to read books dealing with certain of the Eastern principles, because it touches on certain atheistic or idolatrous elements from a Torah point of view. But according to those who've read that book, there are a wonderful description of mystical principles directly derived from Torah. We know that the Eastern mystical system derives directly from Kabbalah. How these theoretical, abstract, mystical concepts are being proven in modern physics. Exactly. Lengthy book dealing with it. So they actually are beginning now to ask these ultimate questions. The professor of physics at Cambridge, Isaac Newton professor, world famous figure, charismatic figure, popular press has said a lot about him last few years, written one or two very popular books recently, has written a book in which he investigates this from a position of a top world famous scientist, has investigated, the book's called The Brief History of Time. And read that book, it's very readable. Don't need a lot of technical background. Which has investigated from a physics point of view how you actually can begin to apprehend these transcendent principles as a physicist, not as a religious man, and they talk about God. Now, let's move a little step further. What about the time factor? What about the time factor? I think as we go through this, you should bear in mind something interesting, which is that there seems to be a phenomenon in the world. Again, I'm not quoting your Torah source for this, so it might turn out to be wrong. I'm just telling you the way it stands now. 2 years' time or tomorrow, they might change all this. Right? I'm not telling you now a Torah principle. I'm telling you a simple, straightforward observation in the world, which is that it's very interesting that up to a certain point of modern history, much of modern physics and science seem to contradict Torah. And many of the theories are being overturned for scientific reasons that now come into line, fall into line with the Torah description. For example, the previous theory was that the universe was in steady state, that had always existed in this form. Obviously, that openly contradicts the Torah belief that 5,700 years ago it was created from nothing. The modern theory is that there was a big bang of creation. The only problem is they're a little bit out with the time right now. They're a couple of years out, time-wise. But the fact that there was nothing before that's apprehendable, and then suddenly it came into being as we know it, is in perfect agreement with our description. Evolution is another case in point. If we get time, we'll get to that also. But there are many very interesting phenomena that science is coming closer and closer to proving, in technical terms, what we say in Torah terms. In the field of subatomic physics, I'm not going to go into details again, there's a very interesting trend, that is that there was originally an attempt to describe the world in subatomic physics terms, quantum theory and other theories of physics, to try and describe the world in the broadest principles possible. That is always the tendency of science, to try and find the underlying principle. And the world was describable in terms of many different principles. The modern attitude is that they've got it down to two. That means with only two principles, with only two principles, relativity and quantum mechanics, those two, one can describe the whole universe. They're still searching for what they call GUTs, grand unifying theories, GUTs, grand unifying theory, what they call GUTs, which are an attempt to find one theory that describes everything. So far, no physicist has yet successfully managed to describe relativity and quantum mechanics in one overall system, which would be the description of the existence of the universe, which actually is a very valid Torah technique, because in the Kabbalistic system, wisdom is defined as the ability to bring many things down to one thing, or to fewer principles, and then those principles down to fewer principles, until one grasp of one thing explains everything, which is exactly the Torah point of view. So it's remarkable that as they shrink down to more all-encompassing theories, fewer in number, the nature of the theories is much more corresponding to Torah belief. And I'll share with you one or two literally incredible examples that even if you're not a physicist at all, will blow you away. Let's take one as a case in point. You'll have to hold on to your shaitu for this. We can have a little fun this evening, no? Let's start with a simple example and I'll give you a more complex example which also is absolutely frightening, amazingly frightening. Let's deal with the time factor. You know what? Let's first state the principle. Let's first state the overall principle and then we'll try to illustrate it. The principle is as follows. Let's take one idea that has been put forward by great Kabbalistic thinkers, which ties together the problem of the existence of many ages, past ages, millions, billions of years, and the Torah description of 5,700 years. Let's try and state the principle. There are many, many approaches. If you're interested in the subject, you can contact me privately. There are many books, know much more than I do. You can read up many fascinating approaches to the subject. And I'll give you references with pleasure. But I'll tell you one that's put forward from a Kabbalistic point of view, because Monday night's supposed to be Kabbalistic night. And in my opinion, this is the best way to, in my humble opinion, this is the best way to approach the subject, although there are many others. And you're free, as I said, to take your pick, it's negotiable. What we've discussed on Monday night up to now is not negotiable. And everything I said up to now for the last 2 years is absolutely true and required to believe it. But what I'm saying this evening is negotiable. And the attitude is as follows. You see, we understand, and I'll try and give you evidence for it also. We understand that the 5,700 years that we speak about began with 6 days of creation. Let's understand carefully. It's a fantastic mystical principle. We understand that there were 6 days, 7 days, of creation that began the 5,700 years. And we have an incredible Kabbalistic principle that we cannot understand those 6 days. There's a principle that the Kabbalistic sources, the Midrash, writes, that's called Kovod Elokim Hester Dobor. The glory of Hashem is a hidden matter, or the glory of Hashem is to hide this matter, whichever way you choose to translate it. Means that if you want to know the glory of Hashem, how he manifests in creation, not Hashem, but the word we call Elohim, that aspect of God's manifestation, then the only way you can approach it is a hidden way. You cannot approach it. You cannot gain insight into that world. To give an example, a great Rosh Yeshiva once gave a shir on the mechanism of Bereishis, of Genesis, how you can learn it from the verses, and he started from Shani. You know, if you look in Chumash, you'll see that every parsha is divided into 7 aliyahs. You're familiar, you know what I'm talking about. The first of them deals with the 7 days of creation, and the second starts going into the subject, including man and woman and how they were created and so forth. He chose, he began the beginning of Bereishis, the description of the world, and he started from Shani. So people said, what's wrong with, what happened to the first? Kovod Elokim Hester Dobor, you can't understand that. You can't understand it. We will never get an understanding of that. You don't understand what's meant by this. You have to understand why the Torah put it in. I'm not going into that tonight. That's not in terms of physics. What does it mean we can't understand? What does it mean we can't have a grasp of those 6 days? Let's try and understand. Let's try and switch on a Kabbalistic mind for a moment, abstract mind. The way the Kabbalists put it is that anything that's in the Kabbalistic or mystical or abstract realm, you can have what's called a yediyah, but you cannot have a hasoga. Let's try and explain this. A yediyah means a knowledge. You can have a yediyah. You can know the facts. But a hasoga means that you understand the facts that you can never have. You follow? Let's say mathematics. In mathematics, a person can have a yediyah. You can know that 1 and 1 is 2. You can know it as a naked fact. And you can have a hasoga. You can understand it. You can experience that 1 and 1 is 2. Anything in the abstract realm, the definition of what it means to be in the abstract realm, is that you can have a idea, you can know that the world is created in 6 days. This happened first and this happened. There were light and darkness and then the sun and the moon. You can know all the facts. But a hasoga, to understand in your flesh and blood what it means, light and darkness before there was sun and moon, what a day was before there was a sun and moon dividing days into days, a hasoga you can't have. Before you can say the words, you can have the knowledge, but you can't have a hasoga. Means the Torah can tell us what happened. But to understand what it means, what happened, you never can. We will be able to in the next world when we live in an abstract plane. But in this plane, we can't understand it. We can understand the Moshe. We can have our saga of the allegory or the analogy that we can have. But what the thing is, you can only know when you experience it, and we can't do that. What has this got to do with physics and science? Simply the following. The concept is that in the 6 days of Bereishis, of Bria, in the 6 days of creation, everything was created. Everything was created. Meaning, the laws, the very laws of creation, the laws of physics and science, were coming into being. It must be so. It must be so. If the principle is that the world was created in 6 days, it doesn't just mean this tree and that tree and this bird and this flower. It means the whole world, the whole system. Logic, for example. Logic, the way we understand it, wasn't before. I mean, there was no manifestation of it. And then, mathematics. The symbols of mathematics. The rules of physics. The concept of gravity. All the so-called laws of physics, of attraction and gravity and electronics and electricity and magnetism, all these laws themselves came into being. So the mystics point out the following simple, straightforward point. How can you possibly understand a world when the tools of understanding weren't there yet? In other words, yes, let me put it to you the way they put it. They say this. From the moment that Hashem rested on Shabbos, he created 6 days. At the end of the 6th day, he created Shabbos. As that existence of Shabbos clicked into place, from that second on, your human mind can relate to the whole thing. Because it's all in place and operating. Now that it operates according to the rules, where the rules are the rules, so you, knowing the rules, you can look at the system and understand the system. But in the 6 days, while the rules were swimming into place, while the laws themselves were being created, well, how could you possibly understand that? Because the only tools you have to understand it are the laws. Do you follow me? So you're trying to take a system where the laws are all reasonably, rationally, logically in place, and you're trying to focus that machine on a thing where the laws aren't valid anymore. Or yet. Are you with me? Not so difficult to understand. And, yes? And therefore, there's no way a human who can only think in terms of the laws. Can you conceive? Can you begin to a world? Can you begin to deal with a world where gravity is and isn't gravity? Or when 1 and 1 is 2 and 3 and 4 and anything else you want also? You can't deal with such a world. Because you follow, you don't have the pathways. You only have the pathways in your mind to deal with the world the way it is set up now. Are you with me? In other words, we can take our minds, and we can examine the world back in time until the 7th day of creation. and it will always obey the rules. But if you go back to the sixth day, and the fifth and the fourth and the third, you're intruding into a world where your tools aren't valid anymore. You're intruding into a world where the rules haven't solidified yet. Mathematics isn't mathematics, physics isn't physics yet. Are you with me? It's not amenable to the tools that you're trying to focus on it. So you, by definition, cannot understand. Is this idea clear? Now, what comes out of it? But it's a straightforward Torah idea, this. Not fancy or sidestepping any issues. But if you want to put it in practical terms, it says on the first day, light and dark were created. Light and darkness. But the sun and moon were only created on the fourth day. And yet it says the first day was a day. So what do we mean a day? What do you mean a day? A day is 24 hours. The sun goes around. The earth goes around the sun. The earth turns around once. Is a day. But there wasn't an earth and a sun on the first day. It was only light and darkness, but it's still called a day. So obviously a day isn't a day of an earth going around once. It's got to be something else. What is it? I haven't a clue what it is. It's something else that can be understood in a Kabbalistic sense, maybe at some level. Are you with me? But certainly not a day like this. So anybody who wants to claim that what happened on the first day must have taken 24 hours the way I understand it now is a fool. Because by simple definition, there were not 24 hours the way we understand it. It's obvious. And so the second day, the third, on the fourth day, you can start talking about that kind of day if you want. And even then it says in Tehillim that one day then is 1,000 years now. It says it openly, though. It says what looked like a day then now looks like 1,000 years. Openly it says. So the way to approach the problem of early, of the generation of physics, let's say, or the age of the earth or the universe, very simply without contradicting any science at all, and I told you there are theories that contradict it, the simple observations, but without contradicting it at all, the total attitude would be this. It looks like 5,700 years. But that's measuring only from day 7, when the rules solidified into being and time became time, as you know it. But the first 6 days could well read like billions of years. You follow? It says in Tehillim that by the end of the 7th day, a day was looking like 1,000 years. It already shrunk to that. But back and back and back on the first, second, the third day of creation, it could well be that what was being formed at a rate of atomic events. Are you with me? That the Torah would call a day, yes, and would be but measured by today's tools, focusing on that world where the tools aren't valid anymore, but trying to do it, you'd read billions of years. Are you with me? So there's no contradiction at all. They're right about it from this perspective. 100% right. It is 15 billion years old. You follow me? 15 billion of these kind of years, which boils down to 5,700 of these and 6 days of those. Do you follow? Six, what we call 6 days from a Kabbalistic perspective to describe what happened. But measured by these kind of year tools, it would look like 10 billion or 15 billion. Are you with me? It's not complicated at all. On the contrary, it's a simple way to approach the subject. There's no simpler way. If you want to go back and say that the first of the 6 days was a day 24 hours, you have much more problems than this. Because you don't have a message, you don't have sun and moon, you don't have the laws yet. The gravity you don't have yet because no physical object has been created yet. Now. Good, that's the principle. That's the principle. Think about it, you'll see it's very straightforward, very simple. That's the idea. Now, let's check it out. Let's examine the evidence and see. You'll be amazed to find that when you check out the physical evidence, what comes up time and again in the evidence is not 15 billion years. What comes up in the technical, experimental evidence, according to the way they look at the world, comes out very often according to modern physics, the way we look. Let me give you an example. It'll be easier with a blackboard, but I think we'll be able to make it simple enough that you'll be able to understand. Some of you may be familiar with this, but it's so basic that I think it must be mentioned. You know, one of the oldest problems has been what they call carbon dating. Are you familiar with this idea? They find a skull of a miserable baboon, and they put this machine on, and it ticks away and gives a reading that shows them without any shadow of doubt that this was a poor human, you follow, a pre-human, who lived in a cave someplace and looked a lot like a baboon. And this dating system always gives dates, reliably, according to them, gives dates much more than 5,700 years. It doesn't give millions of years, because the half-life of carbon-14, which is what's used in this technique, is about 2,000 years. So they date things in the order of 20, 30, 40, 50,000 years. But nevertheless, 50,000 is a lot more than what we say 5,700. Now listen to this. Now you see, what I'm going to try and show you here, you may object to this a little bit, I don't mind, is that there's been a certain amount of deception here. I'm sorry to tell you this. The scientific evidence makes certain assumptions and then assumes those assumptions to be correct and proves other things in terms of those assumptions without telling you that they were assuming something in the beginning. I'll try and show you this. And my objection to this is not that it's not honest and not that it's not Torah, but it's not scientific. That's the problem. The problem that a Torah mind has with this scientific evidence is not it's not according to Torah. I don't expect them to think according to Torah. They're not supposed to. They're scientists. They don't accept this whole thing. I can understand that. But they should at least be valid scientists. If you make an assumption, tell me that this evidence is based on this assumption. But they don't do that. They assume that the assumption is absolutely true and proven. They don't tell you that at all. And then they proceed to prove what they're trying to prove and come up with a proof. Not telling the ordinary layman that they made an assumption in the beginning that may not be valid at all. Let me give you an example. All I want to do is shake up our thinking a little bit. Carbon dating works like this. Let's try and illustrate this and show you something remarkable. Carbon dating simply works like this. I'm just going to be slightly technical just so you can try and put it in my... I'm not a physicist, so if I can grasp it, I'm sure you can. Carbon dating works like this, very briefly. Now, if you think you don't have a scientific mind, listen in. Okay, listen in anyway. Enjoy it very much. Carbon, which is the basic building block, atomic building block of all living matter in the world, organic living matter, comes in two forms, carbon-12 and carbon-14. Carbon-14 represents a very small percentage of the carbon that's found in the universe, in the world, let's say, organic world. It is a radioactive form of carbon. Carbon-12 is the normal form, but it can be stimulated by external energy, usually in the form of cosmic rays that hit the Earth, that excites carbon-12 to the level called carbon-14. Carbon-14 behaves biologically exactly like carbon-12, but you can trace it because it's radioactive. You can take a radioactive count of the environment or of a tree, and you can see how much carbon-12 there is and how much carbon-14, okay, by measuring the proportions. Are you with me? So far, are you with me? Carbon-14 is a small percentage of carbon-12. Now, the remarkable thing is that carbon-14 is formed by the impinging of cosmic radiation on carbon in the Earth, stimulating carbon-12 to carbon-14. Carbon-14 degrades to carbon-12 by natural process of degradation. It's an unstable element, being radioactive. It gives off its energy and degrades, what's called decomposes, or degrades to carbon-12. Its natural form. How long does it take? How long does it take a carbon-14 atom to become a carbon-12 atom? The way it's expressed in atomic physics terms is as a half-life of a couple of thousand years. A half-life means if you have a bowl of carbon and there's a certain amount of carbon-14, in 2,000 years' time you'll have half that amount of carbon-14. Are you with me? And 2,000 years later, half that amount and so forth. That's the way it's measured. So what's the theory? The theory's like this. Very clever theory. This is what we do. We take a tree, a living tree, and we'll measure the proportion of carbon-14 to carbon-12. Fine? Let's say the proportion of carbon-14 to carbon-12 is certain X percentage. Good. Now we'll look for a dead tree buried underground, and we'll measure the carbon proportions in that tree. It'll be different because of the following reason. While the tree is alive, it metabolizes carbon. It takes in organic material from the soil and from the air, and it metabolizes and then it degrades it. You know, all biological organisms go through a cycle, and therefore it's in constant balance with the environment. So the proportion of carbon-14 in the air or the environment to carbon-12 is the same in a tree or any organic living material. However, when the tree dies, it stops metabolizing, it stops taking in new carbon. So the only thing that happens is the carbon-14 that it has already starts breaking down, and you get less and less and less and less. Are you with me? Fantastic theory. There's no reason to discredit or disbelieve that theory. You can observe that and check it out. So the theory works like this. Let's come down to brass tacks. If you take a tree that's alive, and you measure its proportion of carbon-12 to carbon-14, you'll find the same figure as in the entire environment. If you find a tree that's very old, which means it hasn't been living and metabolizing and absorbing carbon and excreting carbon, it will have much less carbon-14, because every 2,000 years, the level has halved, and nothing's there to replace it. Are you with me? And if it has almost none, it must be very old. Okay? 50,000 years old. Logical? Logical. After all, this tree died 50,000 years ago, like a modern tree, and it's been decaying, and it must have taken 50,000 years to decay, because we know the half-life of carbon. Carbon-14. It takes that long to get to this level. Problem is this. We're talking science here now. We're not talking Kabbalah. Okay? Pure science. The problem is that it's based on a massive assumption. I'm sure you're racing ahead of me, as usual. The assumption is, especially in physics, I'm sure, the assumption is like this. that 50,000 years ago when this tree died, the proportions of carbon-14 to carbon-12 were the same as they are now. Isn't that right? Even the ladies who don't claim to be technical usually understand. You with me? 50,000 years ago, according to the theory, what happened? 50,000 years ago, there was a tree, prehistoric tree. This tree had carbon-14 to carbon-12 in a certain ratio, like today, right? The tree died and stopped changing its proportions, and the carbon-14 started degrading in 50,000 years. But that makes a massive assumption. Who said that 50,000 years ago? Who says 50,000 years ago there was the same proportion of carbon-14 to carbon-12 in the atmosphere? Maybe there was much more, maybe there was much less. Surely you have to know the starting proportions in order to conclude what you've got today. And the older you get, the further you go back in time, the more unreliable the thing becomes. You go back 10 years, you know, we don't see a great change in carbon-14 to carbon-12 in the atmosphere. Probably it's reliable. 50,000 years, you want to take me back 100,000 years? And you want to tell me that you know that in the atmosphere 100,000 years ago when this tree died, it died with the same proportion as a modern tree, and therefore you can compare it? That's not scientific at all. Are you with me? Not that it's not religious. It's not scientific. It's downright dishonest. You tell me that this skull or this tree is 100,000 years old because of this and this proportion of carbon-14, and the unsuspecting layman thinks that it's proven that old, and the Torah is in big doubt now, and he doesn't tell you that he's got no evidence at all that the proportions were the same? Now, this is what I said would blow you away. Listen to this. Someone showed me work recently by a French team. A French team decided, French team of physicists, I haven't read the original paper, it's in French, but I'll quote you the work, and it makes the point perfectly clear. A French team decided to investigate whether the proportion of carbon-12 to carbon-14 in the atmosphere is constant. Maybe you can detect it, maybe you can prove it. So they started making observations. And they observed for a few years the proportions of carbon-12 to carbon-14, and they found that it's increasing. And it's increasing in a straight line fashion. They put a mathematical equation to this increase of carbon-14. See, the theory that they came up with is that the cosmic radiation that causes carbon-14 to be formed is happening at a faster rate than the natural decay of the half-life of carbon-14. And therefore, there's a net gain. You follow me? Therefore, if you measure carbon-14 to carbon-12 today, you'll find it's 2.5%. But if you measure it in 2 years' time, you'll find it 3% or whatever it is, a little bit more. What does this mean? So they ask themselves the following question. One second. If we have a graph here of time, and here we have carbon-14 going up, at what point in time would there have been no carbon-14 at all? And they projected the line backwards, and it hit the graph at 5,700 years. Huh? Now, that's remarkable. Now, of course, we don't get excited about this kind of thing, because we're near... Now, if you're a logically thinking scientist, you'll realize this doesn't prove anything either, because who says that 5,700 years ago, who says it was a straight line graph? Maybe Hashem created the world with none, and then he put more in, and then he zigzagged it down. You follow? But the point is, so true, it doesn't prove that the world's 5,700. Doesn't prove it, because we don't know what the changes were. But you follow, what right do they have to make an assumption that it's been constant, and that 100,000 years ago, It was exactly the same as it is now? Completely unfounded assumption that if you decide to check it out, probably is untrue. The evidence suggests is untrue. And I'm just as entitled to make my assumption that the present rate of increase has been constant, and therefore the world's 5,000. That means Hashem created the world, the cosmic radiation started coming in, and the first carbon atom started jumping up to carbon-14, and so forth. And that's what we object to. That's why you'll find Torah thinkers who get heated and get upset with scientific claims, right? Not because they go against Torah. Because we don't mind a scientist making objective measurements and coming forth with his measurements. Hashem doesn't want people to hide things. If you make an observation, come forth with the observation. And let's deal with it. But to make an unfounded assumption that you don't tell people, that's not scientific. Are you with me? Was that too technical or difficult? Not too bad. So I'll share another one with you. There's more recent work which is much more exciting. Much more exciting. This is on the forefront, the crest of modern research in physics, just been discovered in the last 4 or 5 years, and it's much more technical, so I'm going to avoid the technicalities. I have the work actually at home. So if you're interested in the abstracts and the papers that have been published, I can let you have copies. There's fantastic work that's been discovered recently which describes the following phenomenon. And make this as simple as possible. Again, if I could absorb it, I'm sure you can. It's like this. Some of the evidence for the age of the universe is made by measuring, right, certain, for example, measuring the light that's coming in from distant stars. And by that we can compute the distances from us, various other changes. Now, certain research institutes, actually work sponsored by Stanford University, was carried out by certain Australian physicists. They decided to investigate a very interesting phenomenon. Very interesting phenomenon. They decided to check out, you know, I presume you're aware that there are two ways of measuring time. You see, what we described before was aging methods, carbon dating, aging methods, and there are many others. Radio argon, by the way, works on the same assumption. They all work on assumptions that are questionable at best. These workers decided to check time itself, not aging systems, not dating systems, but to look at time itself, the concept of time, and how we measure it. They found an incredible thing. There are two ways of measuring time. I don't know if you're aware of this. One is a cosmic method. It means we watch what's precession of the moon, or we watch certain cosmological phenomena. We watch when the moon appears in front of a certain star, and then we take the periodicity until it again appears in front of that star. It can be measured very, very accurately. You can also, however, measure time by atomic phenomena, the vibration of a cesium atom. You're aware of that. Quartz clocks, quartz watches, depend on a very constant vibration of certain atomic phenomena. They've got nothing to do with physical bodies moving in space. They deal with atomic phenomena. The problem is that these two times don't agree with each other. Do you know that? That they are changing relative to each other. Isn't that incredible? Something very strange is going on. They timed the passage, and they were able to prove, I'm not going to go into the technicalities of this, I don't understand well enough, that which one is constant is the cosmic one. Conventional time. In other words, the bodies that they're observing in a cosmic or astronomic sense have got a constant periodicity, whereas the atomic phenomena are gradually slowing down. How did they get wise to this? Because they decided to study to measure the speed of light. You know that the speed of light is regarded as an absolute. Have you seen this work? The speed of light is regarded as an absolute. You know that Einstein's work was based on that. The speed of light is regarded as an absolute, 186,000 miles a second, whatever it is, and cannot be tampered with. It's an absolute. However, light is only part of the electromagnetic spectrum of radiation. It means that the speed of light is the result of atomic phenomena. You follow? Certain atomic phenomena emanate, vibrate electromagnetic radiation in the form of light and various other aspects of radiation that can be measured with other tools other than the visible spectrum that the eye can see. Therefore, the speed of light is proportional to what's happening in the atom. And if atomic phenomena are slowing down, then light will slow down. That was the theory. Wow, theory. So they started measuring the speed of light and found it to be decreasing. The speed of light to be decreasing. Now, they checked this phenomenon up in the following way. First of all, they made very accurate measurements of the speed of light, but they managed to check out the speed of light as measured over the past 130 years. There have been many experiments over the last century measuring the speed of light. Unfortunately, the earlier ones being much less reliable, but nevertheless, some of the later ones agreeing very well with each other. So they have a spectrum of measurements of the speed of light over quite a lengthy period of time. And not only is the speed of light decreasing, but it's decreasing in a predictable way. It's decreasing in an exponential fashion that you can put a mathematical equation to. Now, I know some of you are not interested that much in the technical stuff. Let me tell you what it means. Listen to what it means. It means that if you want to know what's been happening on an atomic level, that means decaying of carbon, let's say, or apparent aging of fossils, right? Which are all atomic phenomena. They are physical, chemical phenomena that depend on chemistry, which is an atomic phenomenon. You follow? Aging has got nothing to do with the moon circling the Earth. It's got to do with how atomic and molecular events take place. So if you want to say that we're measuring something on an atomic basis or a chemical basis, some kind of dating system, and you want to say that this is so many years old, a billion years old, you have to know that the rate of at which these atomic phenomena were happening a billion years ago was the same as now. But it isn't. It's decreasing, which means it was much faster in days gone by. Let's get this clear. It means that if today you measure the vibration of a cesium atom, or the rate of decay or aging of a bone, so the rate will take place in a certain way. Which means that measured on your clock, let's just be clear, you have a bone, a fossil, okay? You're measuring its aging by timing the processes with your cesium clock, your quartz watch, in other words. It will agree perfectly. There will be no discrepancy. Because as your clock starts to slow down, unknown to you, so the aging process is slowing down and you can't tell one from the other. But if you start checking out the aging of that bone according to the astronomical calculations, you'll see it's getting slower and slower and slower. Which means that if you go back in the past and you take a very old bone, that bone aged quicker when it was younger than it is now. In case you're still not with me technically, let me just put it in this final form. These people have fitted a equation, a mathematical equation, to their observed phenomena. And they, by the way, they had another interest in this work. They did a fantastic set of studies on cosmic phenomena that are supposed to have happened in prehistoric times. Okay, I'll try and describe this to you. They had a wide range of interest in this thing. It's very interesting to see. I can't go into it all now. But one finding that they came out with which interests us is as follows. I don't think we'll get to evolution, okay, tonight. This is what they discovered. Listen carefully now. Instead of drawing a straight line of time, you have to now draw a curve. That means time itself, at least on an atomic scale, has been changing. But you can measure it against astronomic time. So they drew a scale like this. Astronomical time like this in years, as years tick by. And then a graph of what time would look like in atomic terms. And the atomic curve is an exponential curve. That means if you go back a few years, it's slightly faster. Go back a few more years, it's slightly faster. But as you go back further, it gets faster and faster. That's an exponential relationship. Which means if you go back a certain amount of time, it becomes much faster in a very short period of standard time. Are you with me? Where the graph reaches its vertical phase, which means becomes infinite, which means at the beginning, let's put it that way, let's call it in the beginning. In the beginning of the devolution, in the beginning of the descent of this phenomena, where does that part of the graph cut conventional time? 5,700 years ago. Exactly. They then went on to show, these people had a very interesting set of experiments, they then went on, according to cosmology, to measure certain cosmic phenomena, when asteroids are supposed to have hit the Earth, certain cosmic phenomena that have been theorized to have happened 5 billion years ago, 10 billion years ago, and they found that they correspond to the time of the flood exactly. You follow? In other words, what we put on our 5,700 year timescale as certain cosmic events that happen on the Earth, right, they connect exactly with, and according to them you can measure it either way. You can call it 3,500 years ago, yes? You can call the flood in the year 1648 of conventional time, or you can call it 8 billion years ago, and they correspond exactly. You hear what's going on here? Of course, even this isn't enough to excite us. Those are the facts. So now, again, this doesn't prove anything. Doesn't prove anything. And possibly some of the experimental work remains to be proved. Although, by the way, it's very interesting that there's been no refutation of this. To date, there's no physicist in the world. This has been circulated throughout the world's universities, departments of physics, astrophysics. So far, no one's yet been able to refute either the measurements or the theory. Again, that doesn't prove it. They may well overturn it tomorrow. But it's very interesting. What are we saying? We're simply saying that it depends how you look at the evidence. If you look at the evidence, wanting to understand how it goes according to Torah, you're not required to swallow your scientific mind and ignore it, pretend it's not there, and do away with certain observations. You're not required to do that. On the contrary, use your scientific mind. Use the tools. Make the measurements. Do it though, but do it properly. Do it as a correct, honest scientist should do it. Admit the assumptions. And what's happening remarkably is that more and more of these areas are turning out to be in perfect accordance with Torah attitudes, Torah opinions. What we're describing here, I'd like to talk a little bit about evolution maybe, but what we're describing here, of course, is things like fossilization. We're talking about changes that occur in bones and in fossils. We're talking about exactly the things that are used to measure these phenomena. In biological terms, exactly those phenomena have now been shown, at least without refutation at present, to tie in, if anything, better with a Torah description than anything else. But the beauty of what we've mentioned this evening, the beauty of these examples that I chose to discuss this evening, are that they show that you don't have to throw out either. That's the point. If you want to measure it in terms of what the Torah is talking about, it's 5,752 and 6 difficult days to understand. If you talk about it in their terms, again, you can describe it that way in this kind of time, or you can describe it as 15 billion years in that kind of time. And observations are valid and true and correct, and nothing's fooling a person in the world. Hashem is just doing what he promised to do, and that is to give you a world that can be read either way. You can look at the evidence this way, or you can look at it that way, in order to maintain your free choice perfectly, so that a person can do the work of what's called emunah, the work of what's called faith, and decide for himself which way to go, rather than being forced into a situation of belief. Okay, I think that we've spoken for almost an hour. I think, with your permission, it makes more sense to leave evolution, not to a separate discussion. I don't think that in a few minutes we can make sense of it, or rather nonsense of it, in a few minutes. And therefore, with your permission, I suggest that we leave the discussion at this point. We haven't completed the discussion of the age of the earth, but we attempted at least just to show a few unique insights into it that the modern amateur scientist, at least, let's say, is not aware of, but that the experts in science are very acutely becoming aware of now and are beginning to deal with in unquestionably religious terms, that the most atheistic up to now physicists are now dealing with in spiritual terms. Evolution is much less of a problem, but a fascinating subject to discuss. So I'd suggest that we break off. We'll do the theme of marriage, because that's what was requested and decided. Then Mr. Shem will get back and publicize maybe a discussion on evolution, and we'll do that separately.